Okay, Brian. Ready to hear what's happening in the library.
Sure. I need to hear my poor sob stories about getting sidetracked and losing my book and everything, but the upshot is that it's been a few weeks, but I don't have a whole lot of stuff.
But you got your book back.
Yeah, I got my book back.
How did they, you just went to the library and they had noticed it and put it aside?
Yeah, I just, like, left it on, you have to put all your stuff in a locker because it's a rare book library, and I guess I just left it sitting on top of the locker when I left once, so.
So they put it back in the locker?
Oh, no, they just kept it at the front desk.
That's good. That you can rely on librarians like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've written a lot in this thing, so it would be sad if I lost it. But, so, I mean, all that's really in here is, that's new, is some notes of a few weeks ago I got out Bloom's copy of Alan Watts' Myth and Ritual in Christianity.
Now, that's an important dialogue. Watts was very prominent in the 60s. And he visited McLuhan, and then McLuhan later said Watts was too simple. But they were the contenders, the Buddhist versus the Catholic.
Yeah, people definitely really, still people really enjoy Alan Watts and think of him as a very, like, wise person and everything.
Yeah.
He's definitely a perceptual authority.
Yeah.
On kind of what's the meaning of all your conflicting percepts. I mean, yeah, way back in the day, his little book, The Joyous Cosmology, is one of the best things I ever read about the kind of mild psychedelic.
Yeah. And, you know, Dave Worster says that he inspired Watts to write that book because he knew Watts in San Francisco in 60, 61. That book came out in 62. Dave said he'd seen the pictures in that book laid out on some table of Watts.
Hmm. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. There's always a connection to me somehow.
One way or another. Yeah,
yeah.
There's degree separation, but there's no non-connection.
That's right. Even puzzling Evna, what's his name? Philo Drummond has asked me to connect with him through LinkedIn.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he's still sitting there waiting for me to accept him, but I don't like LinkedIn. I don't even know what it's for. Occasionally I'll accept a person, but I think he's trying to play good cop, get in there and look at my business connections or whatever you reveal on LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what are your other links?
Or he's so amazed at this radio show, he just can't believe it, he's been won over.
That would be surprising.
Yeah.
I'd be quite surprised to hear that. I mean, it could even just be he probably knows. He's probably able to know who you are. I mean, he might just put out a blanket request to anyone named Bob Dobbs.
Yes, that's true. But he knows about me, and he's an old guy, and he just got married to a young woman, so he's all happy. He's not dogmatic like Stang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, Watts. Now, I would have liked to see McLuhan's commentary on Joyce Cosmology or This Is It, the later Watts books. But unfortunately, we were getting an early book by Watts. But still, at least McLuhan said something.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there isn't really. It seemed like there was kind of going to be a lot. Like in the back cover, there's quite a few little notes, but it doesn't really have. Like McLuhan talking back or commenting very much, mostly just kind of taking in. He seemed to be reading it pretty closely and interestedly, but.
I mean, he's noting it for information.
Yeah, he's just noting on this page was this idea.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, and I don't think I found a single thing that has his actual, like, making a little note beside something.
Right.
But.
Well, give us a couple of points he noted.
There was one thing on the back cover, he says, page 196, F. Wake, Sleeping Giant, and then on page 196, he had written,
Alan Watts wasn't talking about Finnegan's Wake, but McLuhan wrote a little FW beside Watts's quote talking about this, talking about a cathedral, saying, "This material house of Christ's body exhibits the essential elements of the axle tree motif. For if one looks at the ground plan of such a church, it is immediately obvious that there is the outline of a cross, tree, or human figure stretched between the waters at the feet and the heavens at the head, suggested by the dome shape of the apse. The path from the font, like where you come in and dip your hand in and put a little bit of water on your head at the entrance of the church, there's always a little bit of water there in the Catholic church. The path from the font to the altar represents the whole course of the Spirit's ascent into liberation, from the material waters into which it descended at creation and incarnation."
That's awesome, and that is one of the closing images in Finney's Wake, the cathedral, the triptych with the three stories, and the tree. Now, I wonder if Paige White will say it's a yew tree, Y-E-W. You know anything about the yew tree?
Not really, no.
Okay, well, he's on about that.
The world tree?
Yeah, he has a special knowledge about it, so he's listening, so maybe he'll say something later when we open up or something. But, McLuhan is so accurate there. That is, on one of the main levels, the closing image of Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
The cathedral.
And it's interesting, too, indicating the way that Finnegan's Wake, you know, that there is a sort of vertical symbolism of the development is going through there. It's
yeah.
Not just a big horizontal wash.
Right.
That the idea that if there is that kind of structure.
That's the Ten Thunders. They serve as the vertical structure. You know,
right, yeah,
a linear progression of technologies.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you meant?
Yeah. And a spiritual progression as well towards an enlightenment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's page 424 with television. In the Outer Kingdom, that's the spiritual enlightenment via the extension of tactility in TV in the 50s, 1950s.
Right, and so that would be like getting up to the altar.
Yes. And there's a lot of that imagery at the end of the book. A lot of Christian Catholic imagery in the final pages, including an angel descending on Anne Olivia Plurabelle as she does her replay of the Molly monologue from Ulysses.
Hmm.
It's much where it's a repeat of Ulysses, but he knows more about media in Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So, next point.
Next point. Let's see. Good quote from Watts that McLuhan noted as a fallacy of power and control. On Watts says, "We have to recognize that the totally undefinable and incomprehensible something, which is our inmost self, is, in all important respects, beyond our control. For the self which knows and controls is never, at the same time, the known and controlled. This is the most important lesson for a civilization which aspires to omnipotence, the control of everything. For every attempt to establish total control starts a vicious circle. The complete control of life is impossible for the reason that we are a part of it and that in the last analysis, the system is not a thing controlled, but a thing controlling."
Really good. So what's McLuhan? He just underlines that? He doesn't make any commentary?
Yeah. Just noting it and saying fallacy of power and control.
Well,
there's actually a little footnote there that Watts goes on saying self-control is always a form of feedback mechanism, but there's always a lag, so that literally instantaneous control of the controller is ever impossible. Furthermore, the feedback mechanism is self-correcting in relation to its environment rather than in relation to itself.
Yeah, McLuhan probably couldn't disagree with much of that, just that if you read it, as Harold Innes would say, you don't notice that you're getting it via English, and that has a bias. So McLuhan would welcome Finney's Wake to smudge the meaning of that and show that, watch the medium you're getting the truth from.
Right. That ultimately, the language you're using has, you know, asserted its own form of bias and evolution. And
yeah. Now that
question might not come up as a problem in the grammar of another language.
Right. And then, that's right. And then the book called, that Watts put out in about 66, is called The Book on the Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are. That should be given to every 14, 15, 16-year-old in the school system, so they get it, a simple version of what Watts saying about all that. So they know that. Then they would start looking at McLuhan to simplify or complexify their simplexity that they got from Watts. See, that'd be the perfect grooming for any person, if that's even possible, because we don't know if there are any young people left today. So if there were, we'd do that.
Yeah, if we actually had kids growing up rather than drink cybernetic potatoes.
Yeah.
I mean, it just comes back to some basic wisdom of, things being not true but not completely false either. It's just to everything there's a season or something. And, like, the whole Alan Watts mode is not the be-all and end-all, but it's definitely good mental medicine for some certain stage of development.
He's offering a conceptualization for kids to figure out how they're eternal, that part of the self they can't get at, which is not controllable. That's there.
Right. Yeah.
It's constant.
Yes. Yes, the constant and the unconscious.
The constant
everywhere that you're not paying attention to.
Yes, that mortar language gets you distracted from. What was it that McLuhan said in Cliched Archetype that Milton's message about Satan was that he confused his mind with language? That's what Watts tries to solve in a simple way, but an effective way. You got to know how it is in a simple way as well as a complex way.
Right, yeah.
So next one.
All right, I'm trying to find. I have like a little note here. It doesn't seem to be referring to this same quote, but okay. Anyway, I'll just pull out this Alan Watts quote talking about the flood. For the flood is ever the symbol of that unconsciousness of the spirit, the true self.
There.
The same waters from which the world was made in the beginning. The essential meaning of the atonement is that it is the representation in time of the sacrifice which was made before time, in quotes, of the voluntary sacrifice wherein and whereby the one seems to become the many. By the spell of the word, the true self is enchanted and appears to be this, that, and the other I, unconscious of its original identity, in the same way that by night the sun is lost in the waters beneath the earth.
Yeah, good quote. For people like Watts, go online and his son has a whole archive of Watts' lectures that he started doing, I think, on San Francisco or L.A. KPFK or KPFA in the 50s. And Gerd Stern, our old buddy Gerd Stern, who wrote the letter that didn't get lost, that was rediscovered thanks to Ion, the letter from Cassidy to Kerouac, he was Alan Watts' engineer in the early 50s, engineer.
Cool. Nice.
And, you know, he was only 23, 24, 25 years old then, too. So that's a nice quote. And you can hear Watts. He's pretty good talking about what's going on and giving his position. He really was a bigger guru than Tim Leary, in a way, for the counterculture of the 60s. He was the top guy for many people.
Yeah, I mean, he more delivers something of an understanding, whereas Leary is more promising amazing things and talking about possibilities that are kind of amazing, and if you can, you know, get high on that or whatever, and also the Leary more Because Leary is more like a technologist of the psychedelics or something. He was more interested in the potential for understanding and changing the brain and that kind of thing, whereas Watts is more about using it to just unfold the lesson within it.
Yeah, to remember. Watts is for remembering and Leary is for building a new civilization. Leary is an intellectual, sophisticated cheerleader.
Yeah.
And Watts doesn't go to the game. He's having a private game. Well, Watts is at the canteen. He doesn't run back in the second half to see who won. He's having a good conversation with the person selling the hot dogs, whereas Leary's right out there being the mascot for the team.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, there was
Transcribed
somewhere. I heard it on KPFK in 93 when I was staying at Jerry Fialka's on Roy of Hollywood. He played this meeting between Leary, Alan Watts, Gary Snyder, a couple other countercultural people, heavies in those days, on a houseboat. And it's a really good recording as they argue about what to do with the LSD popularity that Leary created. It's a really good symposium. It goes on for hours. And you get to hear, Ginsberg might have been there too. All those guys were there talking and discussing and arguing about what to do with the sort of hoopla that Leary had created in 66, before LSD was outlawed, I think.
Right. Oh, I'd like to hear that.
Yeah, look for it online. Maybe I'll look for it and join the show. Might be something interesting to play a bit. Okay, so McLuhan is the fly in the ointment of all this, though, you know?
Yeah. It's definitely interesting, though, that McLuhan, at least in terms of his personal encounter with Leary, I mean, maybe he was just willing to be helpful to anyone who was respectful and receptive to his system or something. But in terms of encountering them on the level of a sort of a clash of idea spheres, then you don't necessarily see a lot of crossover between McLuhan and Leary. And McLuhan would sort of dismiss Leary, but it's definitely significant that McLuhan was very willing to give very good advice to Leary, and that he seemed to understand not just this old thing of like that McLuhan, who never did psychedelics, seemed to be kind of the most psychedelic philosopher.
Yeah.
He seemed to really get the most high part of Leary, which was Leary, like, you know, Leary understood all sorts of psychological games with the LSD and saw through that, but the part that seemed most interesting to Leary was this sort of getting high to this really far genetic view, where he would be looking at the present history and present society as basically a big anthill with different mental and social castes, and looking at it, taking a long view of like, yes, well, you know, maybe not everything I say is perfectly responsible or something, but ultimately, it's like a genetic function.
Yeah, he'd say the DNA is with him.
Yeah, to just be the novelty encourager and that kind of thing, and to open up the new, to be the explorer, open up the new frontier and stuff, and to be that role within the encouraging.
Right.
To be that encouraging role. And so it's that role that McLuhan really helps the most. Like,
yeah.
He knows exactly what to address Leary about, like what Leary is interested in, like broadcasting directly to the kind of collective unconscious brain and how to play it properly.
Right. Now, did you see when I posted the McLuhan's review of Masters in Houston's The Varieties of Psychedelic Experience, about 1966?
Yes.
So it'd be really interesting to find out, did he write that before he met with Leary and inspired Leary's turn on Tune In, Drop Out, or did he write it after? See, the timing of that, maybe because he met with Leary, he decided to look into a little bit more and found that book and wrote that review where he says the complexity of the global theater means that none of the Gutenberg arts offer perception anymore. Psychedelics, he said, probably are the best perceptual training for catching up to what was actually happening on the planet at that point. You know, he says, Ion just commented on the chat line, Leary of Leary, and then he smiles. He says, capital L, Leary of Leary, that's Ion. What else do we say? So Leary, McLuhan understands the services of what Leary was advocating. McLuhan knew that nobody had perceptual habits ready for what was happening in the 60s, which Dave Worcester would say, Rye returning to the plane of essence. And Ionis said there was an upburst of something happening in the 60s. McLuhan knew the psychedelics would be the best thing to tune you in if it was done in a, not on the street, but done in the clinical way it was presented by Masters and Houston in their book.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a whole very important distinction. I mean, the whole kind of more chaotic acid test kind of thing, like, you know, get high and throw your brain into a rave or a Burning Man situation or something, can that can really do it, too, and break out its own kind of wild wisdom and synchronicity experience. But the more kind of the idea of the proper use of LSD and training and taking care and having a guide and all that. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you think that had great potential? But yeah, I mean, especially just for the complexity of the time. It's such a complex time that even just in a more basic sense of like, well, I mean, if these psychedelic drugs are actually opening people's minds up to be able to entertain very strange perceptions and ideas, then that's what we need these days.
Yeah, which is what McLuhan said was coming. He said Twiggy and the Beatles and various things in the mid-60s were bizarre forms, but there was way more bizarre forms coming, he said.
Yeah.
And that's pretty well, that's an accurate prediction. Unfolded in the 70s, 80s, 90s. I mean, just Reagan being an actor, being a president, was a bizarre form that people didn't expect.
Right.
And that's in the old institution of politics. So, now, Leary mentions the DNA, and Ion's brought in the new knowledge about the RNA. See, that's what we've improved on the 60s by bringing in the RNA. What does LSD do to the RNA, Ion?
Well, it basically numbs it.
Ah. Well, that's not useful then, is it?
No, not at all. It's kind of like the same thing hypnotism. Does hypnotism affect your RNA? No. It just shows you what you were trying to say all along.
By numbing your mind.
The pathway of your mind.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. You got anything to say to that?
So it takes out the labyrinth of the mind you're staying eye on?
No, that's what I said.
Well,
it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. No, it's a almost like a numbing effect. The liquid nitrogen, the freeze spray. Okay, it doesn't take away the pain. It just numbs it.
So the pain that the RNA creates in the body is numbed?
Pain is not a bad thing, and it doesn't create pain. It responds to it.
So how does that affect, then, the chromosome 14 and the dialogue between the RNA and the chromosome 14?
It doesn't affect it at all. Pain has nothing to do with the rings in the arms of chromosome 14.
No, I mean LSD.
LSD doesn't have anything, none of that. Doesn't do any of that. It's nothing other than putting on a pair of rose-colored glasses. Does that change your eyesight? No. It just lets you see a rose version of those same views. But it doesn't change what reality is, but it might shift your gaze to say, oh, everything is rose-colored when I look through the rose-colored glasses. So if you say it that way, all that does is let you see things from a different light.
Okay.
It takes some of the heatness out of the fire sometimes. Now, tripping is another conversation, but that has to do with the neuropathic endings, which we were talking about sort of, but vaguely, but not specifically, and we don't really know or think you know what you're talking about, but that's a good sign that things are going well when you don't know what you're speaking about. So the issue now becomes, does any outside source affect or change your RNA receptors? And the answer is no, except for those things that align you with your perfection. If LSD did that, it would be all the bomb, but it does not. If it came to the place that that was the answer, then that's all the bomb, but it's not. You've got to line up. Now, the only thing that's interesting about this so far is that you're coming into a place where you can choose paths that bring you back to your place of power, which does affect chromosome 14.
Yeah, so that's the distance between you and you, the frequency, and then how you can layer things to either become a pedophile or a patriot.
That's chromosome 14.
Right. Is that right, Ion?
Close enough.
Cool. This is excellent. Thank you.
So we know the RNA drops do affect the RNA in the chromosome 14. Is there any other things that happen?
No, that's all. That's all right now. Now, very soon, well, see, we almost thought he wanted to make it's your damn glib cliche archetypes, Bob, that made all this superfluous. It brings all of us into this mix, and it has to be this way, and it has to be that way, and we have to have a double-barrel butcher knife to chop your damn head off so you can not have the labyrinth of your mind troubling this pathway that you go back to your place of God. Hansel and Gretel would have been much better off if they'd have stayed in that damn stove and been eaten and solved it right there. We wouldn't have had any of these other problems. We agree. They tried that at Auschwitz with the ovens, and it's the last day of Passover, so you might as well celebrate it. The Passover lamb, y'all, before God, better have the blood over your doorpost tonight. That's all we got to say. You better.
I'm cooking lamb tonight, Bob. Good.
So, Brian, what does this inspire you to say, Brian? What ideas come to you? Laughter?
Yeah. Well, I guess it puts another spin on what I was thinking about Leary and the thing about this. There seems to be a big question mark hanging over Leary, and a lot of people seem to feel that he was a totally poisonous influence and probably some kind of military intelligence character, or if not military, then some, you know, that like, oh, you...
The liberal part of the CIA was what people used to say.
Right, yeah. That like, yeah.
They showed that with the Men Who Fuck With Goats movie. Bob.
Yes, yeah.
Right.
Re-Am and General Stubblewhite or something. What's the name of that guy, Carol?
General Stubblebine
and his girlfriend Riam. Stubblebine came to our place in City Island, the very guy that I was just talking about, and he refused to come in. He wouldn't dare interact with me, but his girlfriend, wife, whatever she was, partner, came in and talked to Carol a bit, but he wouldn't come in. He sat in the car out there on 44 Fordham Street on City Island. The general would not come in to Bob's lair.
Yeah. Just waiting outside is a good enough symbol of...
He figured if I was going to take them out, one of them has to survive. So if I was going to take her out, he'd survive, right? They probably drew lots to see who would go in.
Yeah. This place has mines.
Well, let's ask Ion. What? Say it again, Brian?
In case your place has mines that blow up.
Yeah. Ion, what do you see of that encounter between Carolyn and Riam? What's her? How do you say her name, Carolyn?
I'm trying to remember.
Riam something. Mm. Do you see anything on that encounter, Ion, worth noting?
No.
Okay. Brian, next point?
Well, just Leary is an especially interesting character that way, just back to what... that Leary kind of getting high and taking a long genetic view, that it's interesting. I feel like someday, even if the evidence is false or something, I feel like there's going to be, even if it's just a false attempt to smear, blackwash his memory or something, that there's going to be something that's like, oh, it turns out Louis really was an agent or something. It's just interesting in his case because it would definitely, you'd definitely have to put an asterisk beside the assumed bad light that or poison light that you would assume that would put all his, like, teachings or whatever in, that if they were designer deceptions rather than his best truth he was trying to give to people. Because, like, in Leary, he was definitely, if he did come out of some kind of role like that, that he definitely got high and then perceived it as being, it didn't matter that was where he came from,
yeah.
And that was, he kind of dropped out, even if he didn't formally resign, he still just dropped out in his own role-playing and saw that group as being one genetic force lined up and their targets as being the other genetic force lined up, and he was, like, dropping mana onto both sides or something, like doing the assigned psychological research of the counterculture or something, but also trying to give the, you know, a kind of a, well, may the smartest people win kind of a thing.
Right. So, Ion, what do you see the service of what Leary did and then the disservice, if they're either?
We're still Leary on Leary, so if it made you see something that you weren't looking for that didn't matter anyway, then that might have applied to a quadrant that may have been one of your bodies, that if they were not born yet, they would have been died because of the leeriness of Leary, and Quoker would never have it.
That's right. Now, what do you see happened to Leary's state of being in the 80s before he died? Was he a vegetable? Was he active with Jack Nicholson and the Hollywood crew that liked him? Was he an inspired person still?
Not so much, but it was all fleeting anyway. But I mean, it
yeah.
Doesn't take very much to be much or lose much in that world. They don't. They're not. There's not much there to start with. So without substance, you're not missing much.
Right.
Look at Iggy Azalea. It's a good example.
I recognize that name. Who's that? Is that the latest star? You know who that is, Brian? Iggy Azalea?
Yeah, she's like a recent pop phenomenon.
Right. And she's an example of a flash and then has her 3 minutes and that's it. That's what you're referring to, Ion?
Indirectly, yeah.
Yeah. So what went on in the 60s? You I have it on tape. You said something burst out in the 60s. What was that didn't develop, but you said it was a long time coming and it happened and it was a good thing for a while. What was it that happened that you like?
A premature molar pregnancy.
Molar, what's that, Carol? That's you had one of those, didn't you, Carol? You had molar pregnancy? You did. I think you did.
Yeah, it's one that just doesn't quite come off properly.
Right. So why didn't it come off, Ion? What was missing?
Perfection.
Well, is that what your role in, the completion factor that you bring to it, did not happen then? Do you see yourself as a factor there?
Well, some things did. See, you act as though ascension is just a new thing. You've been dealing with ascension since the Emmaus Road, Bob.
Yeah,
you still
yeah.
hadn't figured it out. So some have, though, on life's crooked, limpish
yeah.
way. They figured it out. So we aren't speaking to those folks because they're already at the beach. We're just trying to get you there.
Right, you seem to be a purist. You say there's one actual liberation and all the others are faulty simulations that don't get you there. You seem to say there is a way that is the only way.
There are clones that should be consumed.
Hmm. Okay, Brian, what do you say in your response on the perennial wisdom?
The perennial wisdom.
Or perennial philosophy.
Okay. The Christian, here's Alan Watson.
Oh, be careful, be careful. You're going to end up in the LaRouche quadrant. Be very careful.
That's right.
Oh.
LaRouche has written on Alan Watson, you know, Brian. So the Alan Watts and Leary are all part of the MK Ultra program set up by Sidney Gottlieb and MIT people. Marvin Minsky goes back. You know, it's a sad trail.
Oh, more of them nigger loving Jews. There you go. Here it is again.
Yeah, and it makes sense that, you know, they want the kids getting their psychedelic wisdom from a guy with a nice British accent.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yes, yeah, God, there's a novel back then, God is an Englishman. That was a famous story or novel or something.
Pop,
remember that
pop,
title?
Pop, no Scott.
Who, Pop? Who?
Pop, Pop, could eat no Scott.
Okay, so we didn't get, so Ion, what is it that happened that was a breakthrough in the 60s? Just a few people actually caught on to the ascension path and did it? Is that all? Is that all you're referring to?
Mostly the White Album.
That was the best thing ever for that period?
So far, but we've redone that 60s a couple of times, so we may do it again and then really put some good stuff in it next time.
Right. Obama redid JFK, and now have we got an LBJ coming in? Or are we going to redo it differently?
No. That was all but a dream, Bob. All but a dream. I had a dream. Oh, I had a dream that one day, all would come back together. We'd all be in the rhymes of freedom. And there you go. That same thing that replicates and resonates. And that's the same thing you're hung up on now. It's how to get back to your power, how to get you back to where you're supposed to be in the first place. As long as you stay not where you're supposed to be, then under that freedom, it's going to be fleeting. You're never going to get there. You can't get there because every time you get there, you separate yourself from your freedom. Empowering, isn't it?
Well, you know, we had Martin Luther King came through on May 19th, 2010 on a tailgate. Is he still that way, or has he been affected by interacting with you and us?
Well. No. You don't want to upset Bernice any more than you already have.
Bernice, I don't remember that person. Was that an INS?
Key.
Bernie?
Key.
Key. Remember that, Carol?
Bernice. Key. Key.
Oh. Oh, Bernice is a daughter.
Yes.
Yes, I think James Martinez knew her friend or something. Abernathy's daughter. Yeah. So, Bernice.
Ralph David Abernathy's daughter.
Right. Now, when you that's correct, when you talk about the archetypal cliché grid, is that what McLuhan was exposing, since he used those terms in his book titles?
Yeah, but he didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know what the grid was. He just used that word. But he had no clue how far reaching. See, his position was reaching. He was just trying to make this. He had a mystery landscape that he was trying to plow. It's very difficult to plow a ground that you don't know the parameters, which are.
Right. Interesting.
So,
what do you think of that, Brian?
Yeah, it's very difficult to plow a ground that you, even when you know it's the ground, you know you're there, you know there's something to plow. You have the plow, you know you want to plow it, but you need to know the parameters of that ground. When you don't know everything you're talking about, it's very hard.
Right. Now, did many people
start plowing and suddenly you're just not on the ground anymore?
Yeah. Now, did many people get as far as McLuhan did with the archetypal cliché grid? Was he unique, or he was plowing old ground by other people?
Well, if you ask McLuhan, he said he never. He's still figuring it out.
Yeah, yeah. But what do you see? Who did he replay? Who got as far as he did?
Bobby Derringer.
Robert Derringer. Who's that? There's Rick Derringer. Was a musician. So Bobby Derringer lived in the 20th century?
No.
All right. See, we'll look that up. Robert Derringer. Okay. Do you have another quote or something you want to do, Brian?
Yeah, there's another good Alan Watts one here. the Christian consciousness cannot understand Lucifer's mistake because it is making the same mistake itself. It thinks that it is self-conscious and that it can commit the evil of self-love. So I thought that was interesting. And then a little bit later he says, perpetually he finds that his will mocks him with masks, that the honest act of the will has a dishonest intent forever and ever in an exasperating infinite progression. Thus it is not at all surprising that the Christianity mentality is profoundly haunted by the devil, for it finds the liar everywhere, even in admitting the lie. The saint realizes that he is proud of his humility, and worse, proud because subtle enough to realize that he is proud.
Any comment on that, Ion, from you?
No.
The lying and truth aspect there misses the effect of the printing press, Brian. And see, that's where it's simple. It's archetypal cliche. Is Alan Watts stuck in the archetypal cliche grid, Ion?
In the in the tiny note chart, yes.
From the perspective of the tiny note chart.
Yes.
Yeah. Did Watts ascend in any form before he died in 1973? Before he transitioned?
A Derringer is generally the smallest usable handgun of a given caliber.
So Bobby Derringer is the armament, the gun manufacturer?
Do.
I see. That would be in the 19th century calendar if you can look it up. So he got as far, eh? So, but what about Alan Watts? Did he, of the gang, Leary, McLuhan, Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, a few other beat poets, did Watts get the furthest in understanding himself, dropping his understanding of himself, ascending?
We'd say no.
You don't see any of them getting very far, right? Anybody recommend? What about Paul Krasner? The editor of The Realist, still alive, still functioning as a comedian. Is it hard to make judgments or to make statements without appearing judgmental? Okay, Ian's not speaking right this moment, so go ahead, Brian, the next point. Well, could you read the first sentence on Lucifer again?
Sure. The Christian consciousness cannot understand Lucifer's mistake because it is making the same mistake itself. It thinks that it is self-conscious and that it can commit the evil of self-love.
It thinks it can commit the evil of self-love.
Mm-hmm. I think he's just, he seems to more just having to do with that it's the illusion of separateness in the first place, that it's a buying into the idea that you could love or not love yourself, that there's even a coherent self to love, that you can create a division between the thing you're loving and the thing that's loved when you're talking about yourself, and so that it's like you're already living in a split consciousness world when you think that you can commit this prideful sin.
Right.
And that you find that you're always committing it anyway, that like you can't escape it, like a kind of a more almost Nietzschean or something realization of that whatever your seemingly good moral thing you're doing in your brain has a kind of a dark shadow side, or an evil in quotes rationalization or something, that like, oh, I'm so humble, but you're eager to be humble because it creates a feeling of pride in how humble you are.
Yeah, now all that you're saying is what I call the world of psychological connectives, and it's hard to figure out where anybody is discussing their self-consciousness and judging themselves. That's why I find McLuhan's general statements about collective media effects are actually something that people, more than one person, could understand. Like, there's all kinds of suggested responses I could make to what he wrote there. You know, you could argue over self-consciousness and this and that. McLuhan wipes that all away and just deals with the collective effects of media. And that seems to be, to me, more useful. Because people aren't ever going to stop their self-talk to themselves about how they're doing, and they've got their own terms. And he's and Watts is judging that.
Yeah, and also, you know, that, well, because McLuhan figures out how to sweep the whole ground away. And at least posit that this whole drama is happening in an arena that is a, this arena too shall pass. A fact of print, you know?
Let me just see if anybody would like to comment till Ian comes back. Let's see. Chad, would you like to comment? He's not functioning. Corbin, you like to comment? Maybe he got cut off. Oh, no, there's Corbin. You have no comment, Corbin?
Comments. Should I burst out as a comet? Am I a comet? Are you a comet? Are you bursting through the sky?
No. C-O-M-M-E-N-T.
Should I make a comment? Yeah, I would have to.
Not calling me yet, right at the top of the hour, the beginning of the show, and screwing up my phone. That's very nice.
I called at 5.
You
didn't screw up your phone. Yeah, I called at 5. I didn't call
you didn't
your
leave
own
a message.
Phone.
That's what's good. You didn't leave a message. No, you mean you called here. I'm talking about calling my personal phone.
Yeah, no, I called last week by mistake.
Yes.
Because of the way it was put in my phone, and you're actually Achieve Radio because of an acronym pops up the first number in my phone.
Yeah, I get it.
And I have about 300 phone numbers. Now, what I do find
interesting. Did you ever listen to Alan Watts on KPFK?
Of course. Let me get to that. The Alan Watts thing, they've played this many a times, and they've commented on this, and they were all under the influence of, shall we say, lysergic acid diethylamide. And it was Alan Watts, Allen Ginsberg, Timothy Leary,
Gary
and several other of them, Gary Snyder, and several other of them on his houseboat. And they were all trying to basically fumble about what is the best way that we can turn on, tune in, turn out, tune off, tune out, blast off, whatever freaking thing you want to put up on it. And this session went on for a good 9 hours, if I recall correctly. Very long time. And they were discussing it in so many different ways, and they all disagreed to the point that none of them agreed on anything. So essentially, that's where it leaves at. None of us we may agree to disagree, which is always the most proper politics, if you will, but we will never agree on, oh, that's pretty, that's art, that's music, that's this, that's that, that's what's happening and all that. But I would have to say that this is all in a tomb by now. Essentially, I am sort of dead off. The 60s has disappeared. It's dead, gone, obsolete. We've zapped now into the 21st century, okay? Now, what's happening now, there's such a, I see a more, how would we put it, searching for the roots of the actual magical potential of somewhat psychedelic rituals, not involving psychedelic drugs, but actually a consciousness of the tribal sense in the most remote areas of Africa, the Pan-Asian community, the Islamic community, and then America is so far removed from all this, and at the same time we're becoming a slave society, and that's what's driving our society. Not only, and it's obsolete now to even use the Eisenhower term. I don't even know that he coined it. It was probably one of his speech writers. But regardless, the military-industrial complex, yes. Oh, has anybody seen this going clear on the HBO thing, the HBO Scientology thing?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Yes. Has anybody, well, ask somebody later. And there's another one. Oh, yeah.
All participants are now unmuted.
Everybody, so people can say if they saw the documentary.
Well, anyway, what I see is everybody searching for their roots, and I see a much more tribalistic sense, a much more ancient, but since everything's everywhere at one time, this is what we've been working on. When I say we, I don't mean anybody specifically. I mean what Bob, Ion, myself, and many other individuals, Brian, whomever, there's a digital high magic that's happening all around us at one time, and such a real-time experience that time is maybe not the correct adjective. We'll just put the real spot.
Yeah.
Experience. Come here, Spot. That's not time. Spot, you're here. Spot, how did you arrive? Clear Spot. and anyway, there is such
you.
A
B-Fart's album, Clear Spot.
Right, you got that. And anyway, I very much see a very tribal sense, but the problem is the comunicado, instead of being able to telepathically, we can't just adjust to a frame, a picture, a computer, a radio, a telephone, without, there is no telepathic, just, well, there is, though. And I think that we're on the fringe, and that's an interesting show, too. I think Bob's into that. Bob, you're into Fringe or what?
Yeah, that's about us and Ion. That's literally, that show has ended, but it's literally about us. But let me tell you this, Corbett. Now, let me tell you about this. I just read a quote by Ted Carpenter, McLuhan's associate, yesterday, and he said he did not... And he studied, he went to the primitive tribe to the edge of the world, as you were mentioning, and he said he found that he didn't have to go there anymore in the 70s and 80s because the most primitive, new kinds of primitive conditions were happening in cities in North America. So that's what you're partly saying, that the ESP is here, and I've written about that, cloning ESP. So our definitions of what happened in the past and whether we rediscover it and what's happening now, which is pretty new, and it's close to anything before, that's the issue. So, Brian, do you have something to say about that, or anybody else have something to say about that?
I don't really need to add anything to that. That's all good.
You would agree with Corbin what he was trying to say there?
Yeah,
it's the collectivity part that's the problem, not individual autonomy. Everybody's got more than enough autonomy. And it's a slave on the media collective grids, archetypal grid level that Corbin's complaining about. The slavery within the Android meme of its own parts.
Yeah, but is this just meant to be? Is that part of it? Or are we supposed to bypass it through a collective, unconscious, subconscious, or conscious?
Well, we claim we are the catalyst. Iandom is the catalyst for that breakthrough. We say there can be a breakthrough. Ion says there can be. More Ion addresses the individual because many people won't get that far and will die. But then they'll be swept back here under new lockdown Bob rule conditions or Connie rule conditions. But we actually claim that we've got the guts, the wits, the resources to do what you said, you just suggested could be the hope. That's our point here.